Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Lawyers for senior White House political advisor Karl Rove are not disputing new reports that Rove told Time magazine reporter Matthew Cooper the identity of a CIA agent. According to Newsweek, Karl Rove did not mention Valerie Plame's name directly, but said that she was the wife of former Ambassador Joseph Wilson. Wilson, you'll remember, made a trip to Africa and subsequently criticized Bush administration claims of evidence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Soon after, columnist Robert Novak wrote that sources told him, Wilson's trip was authorized by his wife, CIA agent Valerie Plame. It's illegal to out an undercover agent, and a federal investigation was launched. Last week, New York Times reporter Judith Miller, who never wrote Plame's name but was working on a story, was jailed for refusing to reveal her sources, while Time magazine reporter Matt Cooper narrowly avoided jail time, saying his source had released him from confidentiality. Reports say that source is Karl Rove. We're joined by MSNBC political analyst Lawrence O'Donnell, who first broke this story based on his sources. But Lawrence, Newsweek is basing their reports on emails released by Time magazine to the prosecutor.
Yes, now Newsweek is in possession of at least one email, and Newsweek is capable of quoting from the email, which solidifies the story even more and has forced Karl Rove's lawyer into yet another story change. He's changed his story every day since I made my first comments. He first denied that there was any possibility that Rove said anything about Valerie Plame. Now he's simply denying that Karl Rove used Valerie Plame's name, which has absolutely no legal meaning in the statute. In the law, you would not be required to use her name to be revealing her cover. He clearly, and I've always suspected this, used a phrase like Wilson's wife or something like that, which is exactly functionally the same.
Well, remind us of what the law does say.
First of all, Valerie Plame has to be a covert agent, and the law has a definition of that, which she might or might not fit. I would assume this prosecutor established immediately that she fits that definition. To break the law, Karl Rove would have to be an authorized person. That means he'd have to have a security clearance that allows him to know this. He could know this without the security clearance if someone who did have the security clearance then deliberately told him. That person would have committed a crime under this law, not Rove. In order to commit the crime, you have to know that the CIA is taking active measures to hide her identity. There are plenty of people working for the CIA that the CIA takes no active measures to hide their identity. So there's a bunch of technical distinctions in the law that are necessary in order to be found guilty of violating it.
Well, this recent news, what kind of implications do you think it has that Karl Rove, at the very least, said that Joseph Wilson's wife was a CIA agent?
If you were to move back 2 years ago, this would be absolutely shocking news. It is exactly 2 years today that Karl Rove had his communication with Matt Cooper, according to the evidence that we now know. The president took this so seriously, this revelation of this CIA agent's identity, that he appointed a special prosecutor to find out exactly this. If the president is going to be stuck with the legal niceties of perhaps Karl Rove's specific legal conduct doesn't fit a crime, then the president will have to backtrack on his initial statements about this, which is that this is a very, very grave thing for anyone to have done. I don't see how the president can suddenly turn legalistic. For example, if Karl Rove is not indicted for this, he certainly did specifically what the president said is an awful thing to do.
Well, sources close to Karl Rove are saying, according again to Newsweek, that this wasn't an effort to out a CIA agent. It was an effort to discourage Time magazine from publishing things that turned out to be false.
It doesn't matter, Robin. It's like saying, I didn't put this false deduction on my tax return, to mislead anybody. It doesn't matter what your intent is in revealing a covert agent's identity. It has nothing to do with whether you thought it was you were trying to help somebody or hurt somebody. That intent has nothing to do with this crime.
Lawrence O'Donnell, political analyst for MSNBC. Do you think we'll be hearing any news as to whether Karl Rove will be testifying soon? I mean, what do you think we should look for in the near future?
That's the next shoe. The prosecutor has new information. Is he going to call Karl Rove back into the grand jury, or is he going to change Karl Rove's status to target, which it has not yet technically been? Target is a status you get only when the prosecutor thinks that you are basically guilty of a crime. So we're going to look for those developments. Does his status change? Will anyone tell us that his status has changed? His lawyer won't tell us, and the prosecutor won't tell us. And will we even know whether he's been subpoenaed back into the grand jury? That's secret information that Rove can disclose. Nothing prevents Rove from telling us everything about his participation in this investigation. But Rove and his lawyer are now at the end of the road in terms of their ability to speak publicly, so they won't be telling us anything more about what develops.
Political analyst Lawrence O'Donnell, thank you.
Thank you.
About 50,000 people attended somber ceremonies today at Srebrenica, the site 10 years ago of the worst massacre in Europe since World War II. On July 11, 1995, Serb forces in Bosnia overran the supposed safe zone, a UN-protected enclave, and rounded up thousands of people, murdering nearly 8,000 Muslim men and boys. Today, the remains of more than 570 newly identified victims of the massacre were buried at the main cemetery in Srebrenica. The slaughter 10 years ago spurred a NATO bomb of Serb positions, but not before thousands of Muslims were killed. And today, British Foreign Secretary Jack Straw said, "It is to the shame of the international community that this evil took place under our noses and we did nothing." Well, Mohamed Duraković was 20 years old when Serb troops came to his hometown. He and his father decided to escape through the forest, which was filled with heavily armed Serb forces. And he joins us on the line now to tell the story. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Can you take us back then? What was happening as Serbs captured what was supposed to be an area protected by UN troops from the Netherlands? Did you think the Dutch UN troops were going to protect you?
Yes, I think everybody in that enclave was under the impression that most civilians will be protected from attacks.
And when did you realize it was not going to be safe there and the Dutch were overwhelmed?
I think most people realize that they will not be protected the moment the Dutch asked them to leave the compound. This is where most men and boys were separated from their families, and most women and children were placed in the buses and evacuated out of the enclave, while the rest of the enclave population, those boy and men, were taken to execution fields.
Right, which you didn't know then, but you soon found out, and some suspected. And Mohamed, a lot of people at that time got on Serbian buses thinking, well, they'll exchange us for other prisoners. Why did you choose to run? What made you decide to run?
I did not have confidence that the Serb army would actually pay any attention to Geneva Convention. So I felt very much that I will not be given any protection under Geneva Convention as a prisoner of war or treated as a civilian. Therefore, I felt very much that I would have a much bigger chance of survival if I just tried to fight my way out.
Well, and now here comes this horrendous trek through forests and through roads trying to avoid the Serb forces. Did you know where you were going?
Most of the time, no. I knew in which direction is south, so I kept walking south, trying to just avoid all the Serbian patrols and Serb patrols and ambushes.
And now, you know, you're days on the road, days on the run, and I wonder, where did you get your food?
Well, food has been especially difficult to get because most villages that I walked through were already ethnically cleansed in 1992, spring of 1992. So there was no crops available in that area. So one of the major reasons behind going back to Srebrenica was to revisit those villages that were run over in July 1995, because I knew that those villagers left their crops, their potatoes and all the other vegetables behind them.
You talk about passing through these towns that had been ethnically cleansed previously and that they were like ghost towns, and there was this eerie scene that you've described to us of animals just walking up to you.
One of the images that I remembered is the one of just ordinary small village animals, like a little calf would run up to you. Like, it's quite disturbing and difficult to explain. It was almost like a twilight zone. Everything was absolutely turned upside down. The houses have been burned down. The men and women of the village were executed. Some animals on the side road were lying dead. And suddenly you walk into this kind of village in the middle of the night, and then you would be surprised by this animal, calf or sheep or dog, that would run up to you and just look like he or she wanted to join you. So sometimes we were placed with the difficult decision of trying to chase away especially dogs from us, because we were afraid that once the daybreak comes, we may be discovered by because of those animals that would hang out around our group.
And that must have been tough, you know, to see the need in their eyes. I mean, that's a very powerful image. I know you also, in these travels, you came across people who were wounded and people who were dying and people who were dead. You had to take a very practical approach to some of that.
Yes. Unfortunately, at that time, I very much did not believe that I will survive. The chances of survival were so low. But I felt very much, instead of giving up like most people did and just turning myself into the service, I tried to make the best out of it. And from those that did not need any more food or any more any other sort of practical things, supplies or ammunition, we've collected ammo and food items from them so we could share with the rest of the group that was still alive and still very motivated to continue on.
Oh, that's another tough decision, to take food or supplies off the body of someone else. That's a pretty desperate move.
Well, in desperate need, I guess in desperate circumstances, anybody would do something that is the most rational. I think what war does to a human being, it brings you one level closer to the animal, and you actually, in those kind of situations, you react like on some sort of basic instincts, and one of your first instinct is basic survival. So whatever gets you through another day, I guess that's what you do.
Yeah.
But you're right. I mean, there, it's not easy to make that kind of decision and choice, especially when you come across somebody that you know or somebody that you felt very much. It's a young individual who has lost his life needlessly.
And you, in fact, did come across people that you'd seen earlier on the trip that it sounds like this validated some of the decisions you made. Tell me about the story of, you know, seeing some of the people on the buses that I mentioned, the Serbian buses, and then finding out their fate later.
On one day, maybe a week after fall of Srebrenica, I saw three buses very close to the village where I was hiding for the day. And one of my friends at that time told me that that we made the wrong decision, and if we did turn ourselves in, we would be sitting on one of these buses, and we would be driven now by the Serbs to the front line, where we would probably be exchanged for prisoners of war from the other side.
Hmm.
Needless to say, a couple of days later, we came across these same men who were actually lined up in the area called Cerske Luke, and they were all executed.
Yeah, you found their mass grave.
Yes, we came by that mass grave. Not all men were even dead, so some of them were just pleading for us to give them anything, like hand grenade, or to just finish them off ourselves. Of course, we could not have done that, and we had to leave them there. We could not help them, or we could not carry them with us, because there was absolutely no way to save them. They were all shot at a very close range and with a very difficult wounds to treat.
Muhammed Durakrovic, 10 years ago, he escaped the genocide at Srebrenica when Serbian forces overran UN troops and slaughtered 8,000 men and boys. We'll hear more of his story when we come back. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We've been speaking with Muhammed Durakovic. He is currently working for the European Union Police Mission in Bosnia and Herzegovina. But 10 years ago, he was 20 years old when Serb troops overran the UN-protected zone in Srebrenica. He and others tried to escape through the forest. Then they made a bold decision to return to Srebrenica just before Serb troops slaughtered close to 8,000 Muslims. Muhammed, what would you have done if you'd been captured by Serb forces?
I think I already made up my mind the day that I decided to walk out of the woods. Fear was the major factor in my decision-making process, and it was not a fear of death. It was a simply fear of being captured and tortured to death. So I promised myself ever since I left Srebrenica that I would not be captured alive, and if I could do anything to finish myself off, if I'm badly wounded and I cannot continue, I promised myself that I will finish myself off. So in one of these occasions when I was searching for weapons, I actually found something we call offensive hand grenade. It's quite powerful hand grenade, which I kept in my breast pocket. It's maybe funny, but I kind of developed strange relationship with that hand grenade in my pocket, because that hand grenade to me represented the end of this world. So when I finally reached the BIH army controlled territory, one of the first things that I gave to the first soldier that I met from BIH army was that hand grenade, because I feared it so much. I felt very much that this hand grenade is my enemy and my savior. So I wanted, once I finally reached the BIH territory, I wanted to get rid of it as soon as possible. So I gave it to the first guy I met on the front line.
It must have been quite a relief.
Yes. It was no longer with me.
By the way, BIH Army?
Yes, it's a Bosnian Herzegovina Army. It's not. It's a one opposing a Serb army.
And I want to ask you today, Mohammed. There's been some recent news events. Last month, a videotape surfaced. It was shown on television throughout the Balkans. It showed Serbian police forces torturing and killing six Muslim men taken from Srebrenica. What went through your mind when you saw that?
When I saw it, it actually disturbed me quite a lot, because it just shows to the world what kind of brutal execution they have witnessed, and we now all are witnessing.
And you can multiply it by 8,000.
And you can multiply that by 8,000, and then you may get some sort of picture of what we had to go through while in Srebrenica.
Well, the International Criminal Tribunal of the former Yugoslavia at The Hague has indicted 19 people for the massacre at Srebrenica. Only six have been convicted, and the two most wanted fugitives are still at large. How do you feel about this, you know, justice?
Well, obviously there is no such a thing as ultimate justice. For many men who came from Srebrenica and many women who came from Srebrenica, even apprehension of the two most wanted war criminals, I think, would not be enough. Placing under arrest Radovan Karadzic and Ratko Mladic, it's a symbolic move, but not a practical one. Making sure that Srebrenica population can heal its wounds and continue on with their life, those few who remain today in Srebrenica, is, I think, the most important task of Bosnian government, Bosnian community, and international community.
Do you think there is more than one guilty party? Or
I think that everybody, every single person that is responsible for any atrocities, war crimes, or terrorism should be brought to justice. And those people who have carried out these kind of activities should really be pointed out and brought to justice. That includes everybody. I'm not saying only on the Serb side. I'm saying that includes everybody in Bosnian conflict. Mm-hmm.
Well, Serbs in the region are planning to erect their own memorial to war victims near Srebrenica today, the anniversary of the massacre. Your thoughts on Serbs who perpetrated the massacre on the Muslims? Your thoughts on their having this memorial?
Having this memorial, it's a purely political move. I think everybody who suffered this great loss in Bosnia-Herzegovina deserves respect and deserves to be commemorated. However, coming up with the date, it's purely politically motivated, because this date has been moved from, I think, September, just for the political purposes. Mm-hmm. Everything that the Serb side is doing is to actually put an equal sign between all the parties in Bosnian conflict. They're trying to make everybody equally guilty. So it does not surprise me when the Serb political leadership have decided to move the date.
Mohammed, we catch you as you're about to take part in a memorial walk, recreating the journey from Tuzla to Srebrenica. What will that mean to you? Why do you want to do that?
I think it's important to a symbolic perspective. I think it's important also for me to go back and meet most of these men that I have not seen in 10 years, because they got dispersed throughout the world. I really hope that by walking back, we will be able to reverse some of these tragic events of Srebrenica in order to support local population and to show them that we do care. And what we need the most today is to encourage local population, which are mostly elderly women, to carry on with their life. And symbolically, to at least show our appreciation for their enthusiasm and energy they're putting in trying to rebuild their burned-down houses.
Mostly elderly women, because 8,000 men and boys were killed. Mohammed, you say you want Srebrenica to be remembered. I'm afraid that many Americans didn't understand the conflict at the time, and may not, you know, that Srebrenica has been replaced by 9/11, by London, by Iraq. Do you worry that people have actually forgotten?
I think people have very short memory when it comes to other people's misfortunes. So this is why I think it's important for us to talk about it, because Srebrenica does can happen anywhere else in the world. We need to continue talking about what happened, to learn from mistakes, and hope that this will not repeat somewhere else in the world.
Well, when in fact it is being repeated in Darfur, you know, right now. So you're right. Mohammed Durakovic, survivor of Srebrenica, where nearly 8,000 Muslim men and boys were killed by Serbian forces 10 years ago. We were speaking to him from his home in Sarajevo. Mohammed, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. More U.S. troops are headed for Afghanistan. U.S. officials say an Army Airborne Infantry Battalion will be deployed to provide security during Afghan elections slated for September. Also in Afghanistan, the search is over for the last member of a four-man Navy SEAL team that went missing last month. The body of the man was found by a search and rescue team in eastern Kunar province. Military officials say he died during a firefight and was not beheaded, as claimed by a Taliban spokesperson. Two of his teammates were known dead. One was found in the care of sympathetic villagers. Attempts to rescue all four led to the greatest one-day loss of life for U.S. forces since the war in Afghanistan began, after a U.S. helicopter sent to rescue the SEALs was shot down, killing all 16 on board. That incident and the discovery of the last SEAL's body has raised questions, including what were Navy SEALs doing in the mountainous region of Afghanistan? Joining us on the line is Khalif Sepp. He's retired Navy Special Forces and a professor at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. And Professor Sepp, part of your job involves training special forces such as Navy SEALs. So what were they doing in the mountains?
They were manhunting, Robin. Very specifically looking for members of the Taliban and other groups that are resisting the establishment of the new government of Afghanistan.
It's thought they might have been looking for former Afghan leader Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who is wanted by the U.S. Osama bin Laden is not said to be in that region, although he's on the border. So I guess, you know, our perception that SEALs are on water, Rangers, for instance, special forces are on land, is not correct.
Well, by the mission statement that the SEALs themselves publish, that is the correct definition. The SEALs say that what distinguishes them as commandos is that they're maritime commandos.
Well, SEALs does stand for sea, air, and land. Tell us more about the culture of the Navy SEAL. There are only, we understand, 2,400 of them. So tell us more about what's thought of them.
This is a terrifically well-trained organization for maritime operations. As you said, there's about 2,400 SEALs organized into eight SEAL teams, four on the East Coast, four on the West Coast. They're supported by special boat units, 600-odd crewmen that operate those boats. There's an additional organization known as SEAL Team 6, and that's the equivalent, considered to be the equivalent of Army's Delta organization.
Mm. This was some of the most rugged terrain on Earth that they were dropped into, and very soon after caught in crossfire with the Taliban. I mean, you hate to, you know, speculate, but did they do something wrong in the mission? You know, is there something that they could have done differently from the vantage point that you have? Or
it would be educated guessing, but this is combat. This is extremely high risk, exactly as you said. It's particularly difficult terrain. You send reconnaissance teams and into this kind of territory to find out where the enemy is. The enemy is already there. They're already familiar with the terrain. The contact could have been accidental. It could have been an ambush. This information will probably come out sometime in the future.
Do they try to disguise themselves as Afghans?
Within the limits of the laws of land warfare, they may wear some articles of clothing that from a distance would make it less certain who they were. But just because of their size, the way they operate, the physical size of the men, and the way they operate, that would be harder to disguise.
You've told us that goat herders will find them almost immediately. I mean, it's not as if you can really hide who you are.
In the backcountry, there's still actually people, goat herders being some of the most common, and they're very familiar with who normally comes or goes from there. So the clandestinity of a reconnaissance team depends on the political allegiance or tribal allegiance of these goat herders.
The two dead seals who were identified before this fourth body was found over the weekend were young, 25 and 29. One qualified to be a SEAL just after 9/11. What kind of training do they receive, and does it prepare them for these kinds of conditions?
The SEAL training is famously tremendously arduous. As young sailors, after they finish their Navy boot camp and go to a technical school, they can proceed on to SEAL training, which is 6 months long. The first phase, which is about 2 months long, is just physical conditioning. It includes Hell Week, which is 5.5 days of training with only 4 hours of sleep.
Tell us about what's going on in Afghanistan. Can we extrapolate that there are many of these four-man missions, or do you think that this was, you know, an isolated one?
These four-man missions are sent out as necessary to gain, you know, the kind of information to focus the manhunting that's going on, that's looking for these high-value targets, these leaders in particular of the resistance organizations inside Afghanistan. And in this case, they ran into a large enemy force that apparently overwhelmed them.
Agence France-Presse has reported that the whole operation has proved embarrassing for the U.S., their words, elite soldiers being attacked almost immediately upon entering an area, and then a helicopter coming in to rescue them being almost immediately shot down. The U.S. had to apologize for a follow-up airstrike in the area that killed 17 Afghan civilians. It sounded like a bungle beginning to end. First of all, what does that tell you about the strength of the enemy?
When you're talking in such small organizations, you know, four-man reconnaissance team, that means that it only takes a dozen enemy soldiers to overwhelm them. That doesn't say anything in particular about the strength of the resistance.
Well, and should the U.S. military have known how the strength of the enemy at that point? Should satellites or other kind of technology made us aware of that?
That's exactly the limitation of technology. From space, to try and imagine that you can look at a village or a mountainside and know that people that you may see are enemy combatants as opposed to goat herders, as we were talking about before, is impossible. You need people on the ground.
And to the charge of the French reporting, is the U.S. military concerned about this kind of image after these kinds of events, or is the mission far more important?
I don't understand the agency's use of the term embarrassment. This is simply an aspect of the ongoing war in Afghanistan. What is of more concern is that this may not have been as chance a contact as it may have originally seemed. When the helicopter with the immediate reaction force came to rescue the team, it was shot down by enemy rocket-propelled grenades. This is very reminiscent of the tactics that the Mujahideen used against the Soviet helicopter forces during the earlier Soviet-Afghan war. On the one hand, again, until we know more, it may mean only that the enemy had a very lucky shot with a rocket-propelled grenade. On the other hand, it may show that their tactics are becoming more and more sophisticated and hence more and more dangerous to the Afghan and American troops operating in Afghanistan.
Retired Army Special Forces Khalif Sepp, he's now a professor at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. Part of his job involves training special forces like the Navy SEALs. Three of four were killed in Afghanistan. Thank you, Professor Sepp, for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
You're listening to Here and Now. British officials are wading through thousands of hours of videotape in the hopes of finding some evidence that points to the people behind Thursday's transit bombings in London. 6,000 cameras monitor the underground subway network in London. Closed-circuit television cameras are ubiquitous throughout the city, and many other cities are considering adding cameras to their crime-fighting efforts. In Los Angeles, 400 cameras monitor that city's rail system. Cameras also keep watch on City Hall and LA's Civic Center. And in the city of Chelsea, Massachusetts, just outside of Boston, surveillance cameras will eventually be able to monitor every street corner in the city. Chelsea officials are using Homeland Security money to mount the cameras in an attempt to deter crime. Professor Martin Gill of the University of Leicester in England is author of a study that looked at whether closed-circuit television cameras deter crime and if people feel safer with them in place. Here now is Dolores Handy asked Professor Gill what effect cameras had on crime rates.
The answer is not a great deal and not as much as was anticipated, certainly on crime rates. And although it did make the public feel slightly safer, not greatly so. And after the event, when they were asked about their support for CCTV, they said they still liked it, they were still in favor, but it wasn't as good as they thought it could be.
People obviously feel more safe. Were crimes still being committed?
We've taken offenders back to the scenes of their crimes, actually, and we've asked them to give us their views of CCTV. We've also been into prisons. And by and large, they're not that concerned about CCTV. In principle, they say that if they wanted to get round it, they'd just wear a disguise. Now, having said that, some people are in prison today solely because the images were captured on camera.
I was going to ask, how effective have they been in capturing criminals?
Well, most of the images we get, the majority, are not that good, actually. So when you speak to offenders, they say, well, they showed me a picture, but there's no way they could prove it was me, so I denied it. So it's not just a matter of having cameras. You've got to have pictures that are a good enough quality to persuade an offender, yeah, that's me, I'll admit it, or persuade a court that that individual is the person that's standing before them.
So are these cameras cost-effective for police departments?
Well, it all depends on whether they work or not. Just to summarize the points here, they can be cost-effective, they reduce crime, but I think there's not a lot of evidence to have a great impact of crime on their own. Alongside other measures, sure, they can be very effective. But I think if you've got the view that putting up a camera will suddenly stop people committing crimes and make people feel safer, it's a little bit more complicated than that, and history suggests that you have to do a lot more to prevent crime than just do that.
Your study found that some public support for the cameras declined in some places after they were installed. Do last week's bombings in London bolster the criticism that the government may have oversold this technology as a way to deter crime?
I think they certainly oversold the technology, but that doesn't mean to say that it's not important too. And I think the real strength of CCTV, ironically, comes in situations like has occurred in London this week, when there's images there to be played back to help identify offenders. And I think that has got a greater potential than it has to actually stop crime occurring in the first place. And of course, it'd be very unlikely that people who committed these bombing attacks didn't know that cameras were there. And they clearly felt able to manage that risk, as most offenders do. Let's just hope they've made a mistake.
Ultimately, do you think the surveillance cameras are useful?
There's no doubt at all they can be useful in certain circumstances against certain types of offences, but I think it's a really big mistake to assume that they're an unqualified good and put them up anywhere that you can in the hope that they'll have an impact on crime. You've got to be a lot more sophisticated, a lot better, and a lot more targeted than that if you're going to have an effect.
Criminologist Martin Gill of the University of Leicester in Great Britain speaking with Here and Now's Dolores Handy. We welcome your thoughts on anything on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your full name and tell us the town you're from. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The latest release from singer-songwriter Amy Mann is called The Forgotten Arm, and it's getting attention for being a thoughtful concept album, all the songs about one couple. Producer Andrea Shea has more.
Amy Mann has made a career out of heartbreak, loneliness, and despair. Each one of her songs is like a tragic short story with troubled characters struggling to make sense of their fragile emotions and relationships. With her new concept album, The Forgotten Arm, Mann stretches her signature anguish over 12 songs. On it, she details the arc of a love affair between John and Caroline. Mann says it was freeing to give herself permission to write a bunch of songs about the same two characters.
I like the idea of having the songs be connected to each other, because when I sit down and start writing songs, I usually have a topic or a dynamic that I find very interesting, and I don't want to just relegate it to one song. You know, it's sort of ideas that I like to explore, you know, over a period of time and have some details and some story that kind of holds it together. But it's basically writing about the dynamic in the relationship.
The relationship on The Forgotten Arm begins at a state fair in Virginia, where Mann grew up.
Cotton candy was king.
Writing about relationships, like John and Caroline's, is the stock of Mann's trade. Over the years, she's developed a very particular style and repertoire.
In a word, it's depressing. It's very depressing music.
Renee Graham writes about pop culture for the Boston Globe.
I think that's really appealing to some people. They like the fact that her emotions are very much unvarnished. You don't have to comb through layers to figure out what she's talking about. It's all very plain. But, you know, she's not singing about happy, shiny subjects. She's singing about, in some cases, drug addiction. And she's singing about relationships that always, always seem to go horribly wrong.
On her new album, Mann sings about both. The songwriter says John's character was inspired by a friend who's a boxer.
And this friend also is a drug addict. And that definitely informed a lot of the writing of the record.
The Forgotten Arm gets its title from a boxing move. Mann's interest in fighting goes beyond this album, though. She says she herself heads to the gym a few times a week to spar. After her boxer John meets Caroline, the new lovers head out on a road trip to Mexico.
The king of the jailhouse.
Of course, sharing the burden doesn't lighten the load. Things get bleak, says Mann, and the couple separates because John, once a prize fighter, can't get off the drugs and booze.
There's a song called Clean Up for Christmas where he's basically on Skid Row and thinking, you know, maybe he could clean up temporarily just to have Christmas, but he has no hope that he could stay sober at that point.
'Cause I can't live loaded and I can't.
The album, Caroline tries to help John stay clean, but Mann says Caroline has her own issues to deal with.
And I see her as kind of a small-town girl who is really looking to escape her life in some way and has the idea that a lot of people have that, you know, physically running away from it is going to, she's going to be able to leave all her problems behind.
problems Mann's characters face are convincing, says Renee Graham. She also says the songwriter's catalog isn't for the faint of heart, because Mann reveals an emotional honesty that other artists just don't or can't.
What's interesting to me is, you know, Amy Mann is in her mid-40s, which makes it real. If she were 21 and singing this, who'd believe her? What did she live through? But you know, at 44, she's got some living under her belt. She's been through some things. She knows of what she speaks.
That's how I knew this story would break my heart when you wrote it.
Like many writers, Mann admits there's a little bit of herself in each of her songs, but...
You know, even if I write a song that's essentially about myself, because it's a song and you're trying to impart a certain emotional experience, it always verges from yourself. You know, like whatever details you have aren't necessarily going to translate. So I just try to get them to serve the emotional truth of it, the emotional story, the emotional subtext.
And Mann also says she tries to serve a bigger truth with her writing.
I mean, I think people all have the same kind of issues and the same kind of problems, and they just manifest it a little differently. I mean, I don't know. It always seems like a healthier impulse to talk about those kind of things than to pretend that they don't exist.
Something isn't right.
And while Mann's fans adore those stinging, well-crafted lyrics and that gorgeous, plaintive voice, Renee Graham says a little Amy Mann goes a long way.
Sometimes you do want to hear a happy love song. Sometimes happy love songs are just nice to hear. You don't want to hear all the ways that love goes wrong. But when you need that, she's the person.
Tell me why I feel so bad, honey. TV's flat and nothing is funny. I get sad, I'm stuck in a cone of silence.
Amy Mann's songs rarely end happily, but she insists The Forgotten Arm closes on a hopeful note with the bittersweet song Beautiful. In it, John and Caroline reunite and realize how deep and true their connection really is. Mann says she's even toying with the idea of doing a part two that would explain how the couple got back on their feet. But the songwriter wonders if a sequel to The Forgotten Arm might be a little too self-indulgent and a little too much, even for her most diehard fans.
You pulled up and parked your Eldorado. We said hi and kissed with some bravado. I got out my camera and was laughing. Happy.
Our look at the new music of singer-songwriter Amy Mann was produced by Andrea Shea. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.